Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
And we're back. You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. I am Carrie Weber, and I am joined today with Kevin Clark and Zach Davis, two fellow editors at America Magazine. It's odd, actually, not to say, I almost called one of you father. Usually I say father, you know, somebody is here.
Someone's.
But the lay people are doing it on our own today.
Yep.
And we are going to be talking a little bit about the Notre Dame commencement, which folks might have heard of. Vice President Mike Pence was the commencement speaker there. Zach, do you want to fill us in?
Yeah, so if you aren't totally sick of graduations and commencement speeches, we're going to bring up another. Vice President Mike Pence was invited to give the commencement address at Notre Dame, which happened this weekend. And we were covering this because there was a planned walkout from some students. Some students were protesting the vice president and his policies that he's either responsible for or associated with as being part of the Trump administration. And so we had coverage from Michael Lachlan on this, and which is significant because we knew there was a protest coming because the protesters coordinated with Notre Dame campus police. They let everyone know.
It was an extremely polite protest.
Yeah, certainly. And so,
well, except for walking out while the vice president was speaking, I guess.
Although they walked out silently. When it came time for Vice President Pence to speak, they got up, they started walking, and they kept walking, right? And then I think actually the only sounds were from people who were either booing them or cheering them on. The actual like yelling. No one was like trying to yell in the midst.
Right, which is in stark contrast to our Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who was at...
Had a very rough time.
Had a real rough time, yeah, at a historically black college where she was just booed and shouted down. And the president of the university just stood up and said, if this is how you're going to continue, you'll get your diplomas in the mail. And they continued shouting and she didn't get to give her speech that day. So... You know, and
did they get their diplomas in the mail then?
We
don't know.
We wait.
Yes,
in suspense.
But this was, I mean, Notre Dame is starting to get a reputation, I guess, maybe one they don't want to have, or the institution doesn't want to have, for, you know, having some kind of controversy kick in presidential cycle time. They invited Barack Obama. That caused a giant uproar because of the president's pro-choice position, and there were students who refused to go to the commencement or protested outside the commencement, had an alternative commencement. Although I think during his speech it was fairly well received, and there was no disruption during President Obama's speech.
Right. So we have on the line now someone who was at the commencement this year at Notre Dame. He was receiving the Latare Medal, which is considered the highest honor that an American Catholic can receive. It's Father Greg Boyle. He's the founding director of Homeboy Industries. He's worked with former gang members for over 30 years. He's written a beautiful book called Tattoos on the Heart. And he is with us now on the line. Father Greg, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you.
I appreciate it. I listened to your book on an audio tape, which is read by you. And my husband and I had to refrain from reading it on our way to things where we had to appear composed when we got there, because we would just be crying in the car while driving and listening to these stories. They're so moving.
That does not sound safe, Carrie.
No. Do not read this book while operating heavy machinery.
I've had people tell me on planes, flight attendants have approached them and asked, is everything okay?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Just damn good writing here, flight attendant. Damn good writing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a testament to your storytelling, to your work, to what you do. And you shared some of these stories as part of your acceptance speech for this medal. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
And, you know, and you yourself were very visibly moved. The video of the speech is online. And I think it's a testament to how invested you are, not just in this as work, but as being, as you say, in kinship with people and being really involved in people's actual lives.
Yeah, that and sleep deprivation.
Right, you were out in the hot sun for a while, you know.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
That's fair enough.
Actually, I was listening to you before, and President John Jenkins gave just the most brilliant kind of introduction before he introduced Pence about how we need to listen and listen to opposing viewpoints. It was quite persuasive. It may even have cut down the number of students who walked out who weren't that many, actually. But
oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it was.
Oh, wow. And now, did you have a chance to speak with Vice President Pence while you were up there with him?
I did, actually. I mean, he I guess his family has read my book, so he was saying, my family loves you.
But no, but only his family, not himself? Or was he wasn't accepting
no,
himself from that?
Is he going to plug the book for you?
I don't think he had read the book, but, you know, so I know his nephew, so.
Oh, all right.
That's where it came from, so.
Okay, interesting. And you know him through Jesuit circles,
well,
perhaps?
Actually, his nephew is a Jesuit volunteer and works at Homeboy.
Oh,
that's fascinating.
And is a Georgetown grad, so it was.
It's a small Catholic world out there.
There you go.
We can still claim Mike Pence, I think. Maybe he wouldn't like us to, but.
Now, for folks who might be unfamiliar with your work, who haven't read the book, haven't seen you speak somewhere, could you tell us a little bit, just a brief summary of what Homeboy Industries does?
Well, it's the largest gang intervention rehab reentry on the planet, and 15,000 folks a year walk through our doors. There are 120,000 gang members in L.A. County who hail from 1,100 different gangs. So folks come when it's sort of like rehab. We exist not for those who need help, but only for those who want it. So they have to walk through the doors freely. And then after that, the kind of the centerpiece is the 18-month training program, which they all want to get into. So it's 18 months of work and training, but also therapy and anger management and tattoo removal if they wish it, and so that they leave our place after 18 months and they're resilient and they've kind of re-identified who they are in the world, and it's about healing, you know. So an educated gang member may or may not return to prison, or an employed one might or might not, but a healed inmate gang member, returning citizen, will never go back to prison, ever. And that's kind of the promise of Homeboy.
Is it dangerous for the people who graduate from your program to go back to their old neighborhoods? How do they disengage after they're done with the work you do with them? How do they practically disengage from the gang life that they grew up into?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of mythic understandings out there that kind of suggest, you know, blood in, blood out. This will have dire consequences if you step away. Having said that, an alcoholic probably shouldn't hang out in bars every night.
Yeah.
So there's a kind of a sense of you need to put some distance. And sometimes we help folks if they're living in the heart of their body or their gang turf, we help them move out. But, you know, mainly gang members get it. You know, they may doors. They understand if that's what you've chosen. I mean, 5% of all gang members are really quite mentally ill. They might have an issue with it, but 95% wouldn't.
Yeah, I think we're you're breaking up a little bit on us, Father Boyle. So we're not quite hearing what you're saying, unfortunately.
Oh, shoot!
We got that,
Father Greg. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what it is about your program that makes such an impact on former gang members' lives, as opposed to there aren't a lot of other options, as opposed to something maybe even like prison or seeking no help at all.
Well, I think part of what we offer is a community of tenderness. So it's gang members, like the homeless population, are really burdened with a overly, you know, kind of chronic stress that needs relief. And so we offer that to folks, and you can't really begin the healing until that has actually transpired. So I think that's what it is, but it's all relational. It's the encounter it's connection and kinship that really ultimately heals people. Training will come, as a kind of a side order, but the main meal is tenderness and healing.
And you experimented with a couple of different job opportunities for the men and women that you work with. You've got the screen printing that you make clothing and t-shirts with. You've got a bakery going. But early on, I think I remember reading that you had also tried things like plumbers, things, and then found that maybe people were less receptive to welcoming former gang members into their homes to fix things.
Yeah, homeboy plumbing didn't go so well. we had tortillas. We had a tortilla factory, too, at one point. So there were certain things. Anything worth doing is worth failing at.
Yeah.
So we've had a lot of those. But now, we just added homeboy recycling. So it's e-waste, computers, and all that kind of electronic stuff. And that's actually growing with each month. So that's an exciting venture.
And are the men and women working at a particular plant, or are they going to pick it up, or what role are they taking?
Yeah,
in that?
So they do both. They pick up things and they process it, I guess, in our factory.
They're right looking now at recycling.
Recycling computers and such. And we're using it as kind of a placement for postgraduates from our training program.
Father Greg, gang members, like many marginalized people, are often invisible in our society. So what would you say to someone who maybe has not had any encounter with any gang members or people living in poverty and is afraid of this group? And do you get a lot of any opposition sometimes to the work you're doing?
Well, we used to get opposition, and we're at it 30 years now, but the first 10 years were, death threats, bomb threats, and hate mail. So, but that hasn't happened in a long time. And so now it's mainly once you put yourself in the vicinity of these folks, you can't demonize people and it kind of softens the take, but it's an actual real glimpse of how we are more similar than different, and that this is a human thing, and so we disqualify ourselves because we think this is sort of a rarefied approach,
Could you tell? Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Could you tell us a bit about one person with whom you found you had more in common than you originally had imagined? Someone who surprised you in your work.
I don't know if I ever found it surprising, because they were always sort of delightful and loving and innocent, and always so, gentle and tender with me. I always found it quite extraordinary. So I don't know if I had any, I don't think I had any preconceived notion. When I got thrown in there, I was thrown in there.
Yeah, I think that probably helped, right?
Yeah, I think in those days it was really, truly so new to me that I didn't really know what this was at all.
Do you have a sense where the country seems to be heading with this, with the problem of young men and women getting involved in gangs? It seems to be an issue that's coming up here in New York more than I remember. Out in Long Island, there's been some spectacular arrests made and cases with gang homicides of a particularly brutal fashion. Do you see this as a something that's just continuing apace? Is it increasing? Is it diminishing? Do you have any idea, really demographically, if there's anyone looking at that?
Well, there are occasional spikes, like Chicago.
Yeah.
And then even occasionally Los Angeles. But in 1992, we had 1,000 gang-related homicides, and now that's been cut in half and then cut in half again. So certainly it's nowhere in the country is, where we were 20 years ago.
Yeah. Violent crime all across the board is down.
Yeah, no matter where you see the spikes. Although, you start to get crazy talking, like, wanting to undo the Obama sentencing and all those. I thought we had already gone through all that.
Yeah.
And all the
You're talking about the Attorney General's recent decision to reverse policies on sentencing guidelines.
Fortunately, you know, that was a bipartisan critique after he did that. So both Republicans and Democrats were opposed to that. So that just tells you, I think it's the single bipartisan issue that that they would all agree on, frankly.
Yeah, that
in terms of mass incarceration and how this has the criminal justice system has failed, and maybe we could try something different.
Are you working strictly within the United States, or have you branched out to we often hear about the gang problem in Central America, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, which I guess was in some respects exported from California because of deportation policies.
Yeah, that's correct. We have a thing called the Global Homeboy Network, and so rather than franchise Homeboy into other parts of the country or world, we offer technical assistance. People come to us, and so now we have 114 programs in the United States and 16 outside the country. We just added Tunisia.
Wow.
And so we gather every August in L.A., and so 400 people come from all over the world who have who we call partners, who have started similar programs.
Now, I think that one of the really interesting things that you said in your own speech at Notre Dame was talking about how when working with people on the margins, that sometimes people will accuse you of wasting your time. And it's such an interesting perspective on that, because as people who sort of write and try and think about Catholic values a lot, it seems sort of counter to that. But I can see where it would be easy for someone, as you said, who isn't in touch with an individual to say, well, no, that person is, that person's lost to us. Don't waste your time on that person. But your willingness to kind of encounter people as they are, where they are, is really powerful. It's very powerful in the book. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about someone who you've encountered that has sort of changed the way you look at how you spend your time and what that time means.
Well, part of the problem is that we're so wrapped up in results, and outcomes and even funders, evidence-based. And so rather than embracing an approach that is good and true and right and just, that's what you want, is you want to somehow, connect to that strategy that has heart and tenderness. And then results are somebody else's concern. They're not mine. And otherwise, if you want only good outcomes, then you're going to start to only work with people who will give you good outcomes.
Right. It becomes a numbers game.
Yeah, and we're not interested in that at Homeboy. So we really want to in fact, we hire and bring the district and then the belligerent, we only bring in the violent and serious offending gang member because A, that'll have a singular impact on safety if you choose to work with them, but they're also more difficult to work with, so you have to use a different way of measuring or cease to measure altogether.
I guess it's hard to get reconciliation and conversion into a spreadsheet format.
Exactly. And yet, but common sense serves you well. You can look at it and you go, oh yeah, this makes sense. But that isn't very compelling to a patient.
I'm wondering if I could ask you a little bit about the spiritual grounding for the work that you do. What keeps you grounded? How do you see Jesus affecting your ministry?
Well, it's, a lot of times people are often curious about kind of the spiritual part where you can excise out, whereas the whole place is soaked with the joy of the gospel. The whole place is soaked with the spirit of Jesus. And it wants to take seriously what Jesus seriously, inclusion and nonviolence and unconditional, compassionate, loving kindness. And acceptance. So it wants to kind of stand in contrast to the kind of the cultural blind spot that would want to, especially now, you know, embrace exclusion and violence and conditions on our love and wholesale rejection. So it kind of wants to, you know, announce a message, and it wants to be ultimately what the world is called to become, community. So that whole effort is soaked with Jesus and the gospel.
Father Greg, I wonder, in your speech at Notre Dame, you mentioned, you described Notre Dame for the students as the place that they go from. You know, it's not a school that they go to, but the place from which they go, and how it sort of missions people to go forth and to change the world. But I think all of us, as you say, have a place from which we come. I wonder if you can talk a bit about the ways in which your own sort of origins have affected the work that you do, whether that be your family or your Jesuit brothers.
Well, I think one thing, you know, that a lot of us can discover in terms of the disparity between folks on the margins and, say, myself, is that I won all sorts of lotteries. You know, I won the parent lottery, the geography lottery, the zip code lottery, the mental health lottery, the educational opportunity lottery. And it was all just sheer absolute dumb luck that had me win all those lotteries. And then if you go to the margins, you'll discover folks who you stand in awe at what they have to carry rather than in judgment at how they carry it. So they just happen to be born to drug addict parents, or just happen to be abused in every imaginable way. And they just happen to be born in a zip code where there's constant violence and uncertainty and stress. So, you know, that's just the way it is, you know, and somehow people, we need to have respect for that. But often we don't, you know, we think that you know, it's because we were smart and thoroughly good that we've arrived at, you know, the somehow the privileged place we have. And yet none of that is really true. I mean, that's a tiny piece of the pie. It's just luck that allows somebody to, you know, to not have the stress that the poor have to carry. So that's the important thing. It's not, you know, and I was, you know, grateful for my Jesuit education and for my parents and a huge family that was very loving. But all those things, certainly they contributed to something, but they've helped to see writ large, you know, how some people have to carry more than others. And that should lead us not to judgment, but to compassion.
Now, one of the most powerful things about the book, Tattoos on the Heart, and also in your speech that you gave over the weekend, is the stories of the homies that allows the reader or the listener to see the person. I'm wondering if you could maybe recount a homie that's been on your mind lately, or one of their stories for our listeners.
Well, you know, Homeboy is sort of like the Discovery Channel. So once you can relieve stress, And they're in a community of tenderness, they start to discover things. So a homie named Jermaine, about 30 years old, was working about 4 months for us, I guess. And he comes in and he had made this discovery. And the discovery was he retrieved a memory when he was 9 years old. And he was watching TV lying on his stomach. And all of a sudden he sees through a corner of his eye, his mom has walked into the room, and he focuses on her, and she's holding her arms out, and he sees that she has profoundly, deeply slit her wrists, and blood is coursing onto the floor. And then she says to her 9-year-old, "See what you made me do." Ugh. And the next day he was taken and put in foster care. Most telling and tragically of all was that his brother and sister weren't, which underscored him as problem.
Oh my gosh.
And then at 13, he got into a gang, and at 17, he was raised at that point in the incarcerating system.
That,
so he's sobbing. He's a huge African-American tattooed gang member. he's sobbing, telling me of having retrieved that story. And then here was his discovery. He said, I discovered only today that for all these years I had preferred my rage to my shame. And because he had made that discovery, for the first time in his life, he was able to forgive his mother for having been mentally ill and forgive himself for having once been a 9-year-old boy. Well, that's huge. That's the kind of healing, as Richard Rohr always says, if you don't transform your pain, you'll just keep transmitting it. Well, that's the sound of a human being transforming his pain. And, you know, that kind of healing ends in the graveyard, but, you know, because it lasts forever. It never stops. But if we always talk about at Homeboy about the essential healing. If you can get the essential healing down, you'll have a life and you'll never go back to prison.
Yeah.
And of that, I'm certain.
I imagine that the man and the woman helped to heal each other as well, to share those stories, not just with you, but with one another, and realize that they're not alone in this process. They're not the only ones who need to be healed.
Yeah, I mean, we have so many group moments in the course of a day where they're telling their stories, and they discover they own their stories. They tell them perhaps for the first time without shame. And then they discover that they're the hero of their own stories when all along they felt that they were in fact the villains of their own stories. And that's a huge insight and healing in itself. And so that happens quite a bit, yeah.
In that type of healing, I mean, you talk about only really is possible when you you create a community of tenderness. What are the ingredients to a community of tenderness?
Well, you know, I think at Homeboy we have kind of two kinds of spiritualities that undergird our efforts there. One is Ignatian, of course, but the other one is Jean Vanier and the L'Arche communities, you know, and Jean Vanier always says that the highest form of spiritual maturity is tenderness. And I think that's correct, because otherwise love stays in the air or in your head or even in your heart. But unless it becomes tenderness, it never becomes connective tissue, and it doesn't join you to the other. And that's kind of essential. I mean, we'll say things like, you know, the relationship is all and very essential, which is true.
It sounds like there are...
the methodology is tenderness, and that's kind of the key.
It sounds like there are lessons there that could apply to any family, you know, maybe not just families that are dealing with the kind of trauma that you were just describing and the challenges that many of the kids you work with have experienced throughout their childhoods.
But I also think it's true of, you know, like we have a school, gang members go there, you know, and they're not difficult to educate. They're impossible to educate. And yet they show up every day and they graduate. And it's not because, oh, we changed textbooks, or we just found a new way to teach geometry. The teachers love them, and they know this. And the teachers know their names, and they know them, and it's exquisitely mutual. So, I mean, I think it's true just about anywhere, you know, in institutions, in correctional institutions, in you know, educational institutions, well, just everywhere. That the relationship is everything. So once people feel connected, then what can't we do together as a people, you know? And so creating a community of kinship is exactly that,
right.
Somehow there's, fostering that kind of union.
Yeah, there's real power in being feeling known and feeling loved and feeling that even though someone knows you, they still love you, which is a tough thing
That's
to grasp.
Right. Even in families.
Exactly. Especially in families. Sometimes I think we can even be cruelest to the people who know us the best with the hope.
That's right. Sure.
Yeah. With the hope that they'll just keep on loving us. We hope.
We do.
Well, Father Greg, thank you for being an example of that love, for sharing these stories with us, for sharing your life with the people you work with, and for sharing in their lives as well.
Great being with you. Thank you.
I really appreciate your time today. And for folks who are interested in listening to Father Greg's speech in its entirety, you can find a link on the Jesuit Post. They have a video up, thejesuitpost.org.
Mm-hmm.
Is that org? Yeah. And there's a commentary there on the commencement with Mike Pence at Notre Dame. And you can find out more about the ongoing analysis of President Trump's meeting with Pope Francis at americamagazine.org. And to hear more of Father Greg Boyle's stories, Tattoos on the Heart is his book where you can get, you know, where people get books.
And he also has a beautiful reflection on America's website.
He does, about mistakes and whether or not people make them, in a sense.
Yes, he says, I thought I could save gang members. I was wrong.
So to hear more from Father Greg, go to americamagazine.org. You can also subscribe there. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we hope you will continue to listen to us each week here on SiriusXM. Thanks for joining us and have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.